All right, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and whenever you are, you're back on the Asian Highway. This is Storytellers in Action. We're in our fifth season, our third episode of this season. I'm your host, Pimo, coming to you remotely. This is a quarantine edition due to COVID. Got our two lovely co-hosts here, Dr. Devesh Das and Farial Khan. How are you guys doing?
Pretty good.
Not too bad.
And also have our lovely guest here. I've known her for quite a while. She is a director extraordinaire. I don't know where to start with her. She's done a lot. She's produced, directed, written a bunch of programs and web series. And she's gotten, she'll be, her name's Shilpi Roy. I'm trying to think Shilpi. You're from North Carolina. You went to USC for your master's in film. We worked together on a web series called Hipsterhood. You've done a show called Brown Girls. I can't remember if it's a show or a movie, but you can talk to us about that. You got a Chancellor's Scholarship. So much going on here. Tell us in one sentence, who are you?
I just can't believe that you remember I got a Chancellor's Scholarship.
You'd be surprised how much I remember about you. You left an impression on me. What can I say?
That's great. I mean, I guess in one sentence, I am a South Asian filmmaker who is looking to promote stories about diverse peoples in Hollywood because I feel like we're all more alike than we are different. And I want to make the world a better place.
Cool. Well, so let's start off with some of your work, and then we're gonna kind of shift from your work into some of the bigger issues that are surrounding us right now. How did you get into film? Because you didn't start with film when you were in college. You were studying, I believe, psychology and economics, and then you kind of discovered your love for film. So if you could quickly tell us about that transition, and then we'll go from there to some of the more political, socio-political issues out there.
Okay, your memory is amazing. We have not talked in years, and I cannot believe you remember that. I feel like you should just tell me more about my own life because you probably remember at this point than I do. But yes, you're right. Basically, I grew up in a very traditional South Asian household, and went to college. I dropped out of being pre-med in the first semester because I hated chemistry, and I remember my dad being like, "That's a stupid reason to drop out of being pre-med," and I was like, "No, it's not." But he didn't push back because he wanted me to be an engineer, but I was not in the engineering school either. So, but basically I got, to my, I was starting my senior year of college and I was a psych and econ major. And I realized that when I thought about my future, I would get really, really sad and depressed because I did not like any of my options for like what my future was going to hold. And I realized I had enough room in my schedule to do a film studies minor at school. And so I signed up for it all in my senior year. And in my first 2 days of classes, I had more fun than I had had in my past 3 years of being in college. And so I was like, okay, I think this is what I'm supposed to be doing. Having said that, I had no training or talent or education in film. So that year was spent trying to figure out how do I do this? Like, how do I suddenly become a filmmaker? And basically, I went to my professors, and they were like, "Well, you need to go to LA." So, so basically, after I graduated from undergrad, I came to LA. I got very lucky, and within the first week of being here, I got a job with this producer named Warren Littlefield, who I didn't know who he was at the time. And so, the interview went really well because I just thought he was some random guy. It turns out that he used to be the head of NBC, like all of NBC. During its heyday, when it was the number one network, like with Friends and Frasier and ER and all that stuff. And he had left and started his own production company. And so I was working for him, one of five people in the office. That's all like who was there. And so I got this wonderful kind of introduction to the industry. But it was from working there that I realized that what I really wanted to do was write and direct. And so that's when I went to USC and studied writing, directing, and editing, and learning filmmaking in general. And then after I got out, that's when I started working on Hipsterhood, which is part of all what you and I worked on. And so from there, it just kind of snowballed.
All right, so it snowballed, and if you could kind of take that snowball effect and apply it to our current political climate, could you write a better script than what we're experiencing right now?
Oh, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, I think yes. Yeah, I probably could. Mostly because what we're experiencing right now is so bizarre and is not following like traditional story structure, you know? I think I could write a much tighter story, maybe a more hopeful and inspiring one. But you know, we have to get through life how it is. I mean, our current situation is kind of bonkers. And I was actually just reading an article called or it was talking about how our surge capacity has been depleted. And I think around now, like when quarantine began, when everything started happening, we're like, we're in this together, we're gonna get through it. And now it's been quite a few months, and even the most optimistic and positive people are starting to hit a wall, and they're having difficulty moving forward in their lives in whatever kind of capacity, whether it's work or it's just personal relationships or like doing the things you want to do but you can't because you're quarantined. We're in a kind of mentally very, very difficult place, even if physically we have gotten used to what the situation is.
Okay, so if you could now take this hypothetical one step further in terms of writing a better script, how would this story and this experience end? What's the best way for this to for us to get out of this? I mean, what's the best way to break through that wall?
Well, unfortunately, I haven't figured out how that happens yet, but I imagine it has something to do with first of all, a vaccine of some sort appearing. Joe Biden winning the presidential election, and also getting out of office all the Republicans that have enabled Trump and have enabled us to be in the situation that we're in right now. And I think if we can kind of get all of those things to happen, we can start to get to a much better place. But there's still going to be a lot of obstacles to get there.
So it's been an interesting week. For one, I know this about you about this week. You did your first phone bank for the election. So we want to get to that in a second. But also, news-wise, we just finished. We're fresh off the heels of the DNC's virtual convention. Kamala accepted her nomination for vice president. Joe Biden accepted his nomination for the presidency. Other news, Steve Bannon was arrested for fraud on the Build a Wall campaign. Seems like everybody around Trump's circle is getting arrested or indicted or convicted or something along those lines. So a lot happening this week. What's inspiring you to kind of get involved? I mean, you're talking about a lot of good goals, but kind of what's your action you're starting to do? You started with the phone bank. How do you see yourself kind of being involved with seeing your vision come to reality over the next 4 months or 3 months for that matter?
Yeah, I mean, I would call myself an introvert, and I specifically hate talking on the phone. But I am also the type of person who likes to challenge myself. So when I know I'm afraid of doing something, I will usually force myself to do it so that, because I don't like being afraid of things. So that's kind of my attitude towards life. You know, if I'm afraid of something, I really try to face it because I don't like being afraid. And, you know, I'm afraid of Trump getting elected again. And, you know, and so I'm going to do whatever I can to try to stop that from happening. So like I did my first phone banking, which before I did it, you know, I went online and I asked all my friends for tips. And I got a lot of great tips from people, but I found that a lot of people felt like I did. Like this is gonna be, it's a very, very hard thing to do to talk to strangers about politics. You know, in this kind of automated way where you've got the script and you're just randomly dialing people and you have no idea who you're going to get. When I sat down to do it, and I just finished an hour ago, when I sat down this morning to do it, I actually found it was really fun. And it was way less painful than I thought it was going to be. And the tips that I got were very, very helpful, right? The biggest tip is you can't take anything personally. So if somebody is that, if they hang up on you, if they're mean to you, and by the way, there like rarely was anyone actually mean to me. I had one person, and I'll tell you that because they weren't actually being mean to me. But You just can't take any of that personally. And also, why would you take it personally? Because you're literally a stranger to them and they are a stranger to you. So like, you can only take things personally when like, you know that somebody knows you. So that was something like a lot of people were like, just don't take it personally. I was like, okay. And then it also helped that this weekend we weren't trying to persuade people to do anything beyond register to vote. That was it. Like, that's the first step, you know? So at the very least, I could try to help people get registered. And I was like, yes, that is something I am, you know, willing to do and happy to do. And it turns out most of the people I talked to were registered. But we were just kind of gathering information. So who's registered? And then if they are, like, who are you leaning towards voting? That's it, right? And that's like vital information, because later on in the next 3 months, the scripts will change. And then maybe, you know, I'll be talking to undecided voters and trying to push them in a direction. But, you know, when you say you're calling from the Democratic Party, people already know what to expect on this phone call, right? So they're either just going to hang up or they might listen to you. I have engaged with these kind of random political phone calls before. If like, you know, I'm just too lazy to look up something and someone's calling me about that candidate, I'm like, you know what, go for it. Give me 20 seconds on why I should vote for that guy, you know? So it was fun. I would actually encourage people to do whatever you can. You don't have to phone bank. I have a friend who has been texting to turn Arizona blue, and she will kind of with screenshots of these text messages she has with people, and obviously blacking out names and stuff. But, you know, if you're better at texting, do that. And that way, like, they're not on the phone, like, they're not like caught and have to say something, you know, they can take time to respond, and that's fun. People are sending postcards. I just got to a point where I felt like I feel very strongly about what I want to happen with the country. And, I'm a doer. I don't like complaining. So, I'd rather just actually do something, feel better about myself, and hopefully help kind of point us in the direction that we're trying to go.
Got it. Before I hand it off to Farrell and Debesh, I do have one other question, and I just kind of got to get your thoughts on this past week and the convention. You know, I'm not sure if you listened to the speeches. You know, Kamala was talking a lot about her South Asian heritage and kind of your thoughts on having someone like her representing you at the highest level of American politics, and just kind of your overall thoughts on how the convention went.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't get to watch all of the convention, but I certainly watched the more important speeches, and I watched, you know, Joe Biden getting nominated at the end, and how they kind of went outside, and there's all these cars and people and the fireworks, and that was a nice touch. I mean, Kamala Harris, I am so impressed by her. I live in California, so she's my senator, and I remember when she was elected to the Senate, and I had immediately signed up for like a mailing list of some sort and would get these emails from her in her office, right? And they always had this very, very kind of hardcore, almost aggressive tone of, we're going to get things done, right? We're going to make change happen in a positive way, right? But I was like, wow, this woman is working for change, right? Like, and I was like, of course she is. She is a badass South Asian woman, right? Like that's kind of what we do. And then when I saw her speech, she had this wonderful personable quality that I had honestly never gotten from her emails, but it made me so just kind of hopeful and happy and inspired that I really feel like she is a wonderful, wonderful candidate for vice president. I know she can get stuff done because of, you know, her record in California. I think she's a really, really great compliment to Joe Biden. Like they do seem like a very great package. And I was certainly inspired by what I saw from the convention. And, you know, actually I've had a lot of people talk to me, a lot of South Asians talk to me about how a lot of people don't know that Kamala Harris is, you know, half South Asian, and they're upset about it. And I am not, that's not something I'm upset about. I think the people who know, and like, we don't need everyone to kind of embrace that part of her. I think you embrace whatever part of the candidate that you want to embrace, right? Like no person is a perfect being. So like, it's great that South Asians are supporting her because she's South Asian. Not everybody has to support her because she's half South Asian. That's not important, right? What's important is if you believe that she can, you know, lead the country in the right direction with Joe Biden. And I certainly think she can do that regardless of what her ethnic background is. But it is really nice to know that she had, you know, an Indian mother, because I think anybody who has, you know, a South Asian mom has an idea of what her childhood was like. And I think we know that, like, she's going to work really hard. She's going to work really, really hard. And that's kind of all we can ask for at this point.
All right, Dibesh Farrell, you guys want to hop in?
Sure. Shilpi, I wanted to ask you, obviously, you just talked about a lot about what you've been doing personally with the phone bank and things like that. How has the current political climate, along with, you know, the recent activity from BLM, a lot of the political things that are going on, how has that affected you on a professional level? You're an actor, writer, director. How is that going to affect your craft as you're writing future stories and things like that?
Yeah, and I just want to point out, I'm not an actor, just a writer, director, producer. Though, should anyone want to put me in something, I wouldn't say no. But it has affected my writing greatly. I'm actually, I sold a project to the Disney Channel last year before Black Lives Matter happened. And it's about a blended family of essentially Cherokee Indians and Indian Indians, like me. And again, this was before Black Lives Matter, and they were all very pro-diversity, pro kind of these minority voices being put on screen. And we were working on that. And my whole point was kind of dealing with racism, right? Like, I, you know, how to be brown in a black and white world. And then Black Lives Matter happens. And now the entire country is talking about racism, you know? And so we've actually kind of delved into the project to see, like, what needs to be changed, what needs to be updated. Like, when I approached the project with, like, no one is talking about racism. So how do I bring this up gently so that people don't turn off their television? Now all of a sudden everyone's talking about it. So now I have to change my approach to how I tell that story. And that's like a really interesting process that we've been going through. But I mean, I find that a lot of my professional work revolves around racism, because it's ever present, it's everywhere. And I really feel like the more we talk about it and kind of bring it into the light, the more we can actually create change and hopefully kind of lessen the effects of racism and eventually get rid of it. And so Black Lives Matter has been, I think, really, really important to my work, because people are also receptive now, much more receptive professionally to kind of what I've been trying to do. Whereas before, they'd be like, you know, it's TV, people are just looking for an escape, we don't really want to go there. Now they're like, people are going to be surprised if we're, you know, talking about a subject related to racism and don't actually bring up the racism, you know, because it's so obvious now at this point. So, I mean, I think it's a great thing that's happened. And hopefully, you know, all filmmakers are kind of trying to harness it and you know, put it into their work, because I certainly am.
Dibesh, you missed a great opportunity on the actor line to kind of make a play on Shilpi's nickname, which is Shilpinator.
I know, but I was trying to, you know, get the serious answer first before I jumped in with my shenanigans, you know.
Okay, I'm jumping in. So I work in Hollywood too. I have been for the last 4 or 5 years now. I work with a director named Chris Robinson. He does a lot of music videos and that kind of thing. What do you think Hollywood needs to do? And I'm talking large entities like Disney, like CAA, like everywhere, really. What do you think Hollywood needs to do, not only to shift towards just being more culturally aware and this Black Lives Matter narrative, and what do you think Hollywood needs to do? Like, what are steps that they can take right now as a woman of color, do you think they should do?
Well, the first step I think that the networks can take is to put shows about people of color on the air, like my show. So that's more of a personal thing as well. But, you know, what I found is there's a lot of optimism and encouragement about, like, in the process of kind of buying the idea or developing the content out, like, yeah, this is great, it's about these minority people's. We really want to delve into them and their lives and their issues. And then when it's that last step of, okay, are we going to actually put this on the air? Are we going to make this movie? It stops, right? Because they're scared. And there's a variety of different reasons as to why they're scared, but they're afraid, you know, financially, will this actually work? You know, will people be mad that they're listening to these things? Will they change the channel? You know, all of these reasons. And we have to get over that last hump, right? So it's like they kind of have to take this leap of faith. It's not really a leap of faith, but for some reason they see it that way. And put these things on the air so that the general population gets used to seeing stories about people who are different. I mean, I personally love watching things about populations that I don't know anything about, right? It's one of my, because you learn, at the very least, you're just gonna learn something new and you're gonna meet some new people through this medium. Now, when you step back to how do you even get a project sold, right? What are the agencies need to be doing, producers, all of that stuff? I mean, it's kind of the same answer. Like they all have to, again, characterizing it as a leap of faith, but they all need to kind of step up for, you know, bring on people of color as clients, actively promote them and do whatever they need to do to get these people ready to shine. Often people of color, they don't have the same kind of background or education in the business as, say, a white person whose, you know, dad is the famous director is or whatever. So sometimes we need a little more education or time, but like, help us with that. You know, if we don't necessarily have the contacts to kind of make that happen on our own. So obviously there's all these diversity programs that have been helping with that thing. But again, it's always that final step of like, everyone's happy to help someone get started, but it's reaching the next level that's the most difficult, because someone has to take a chance on you. And so
someone
kind of
has to green light it.
Yeah.
You know,
someone's got to green light it. And like, they just need to not be afraid. Like they kind of have to get rid of the fear, all the fear-based stuff. And there's a lot of data out there that supports that people of color are watching a lot of television and they're watching a lot of movies. And so like, it's not that scary. I don't think it's that scary to be greenlighting these projects with kind of these minority and diverse and people of color populations. Like we're gonna watch. The problem is that the people with the money tend to be old white men and they're just kind of not clued in. So it's like fixing all of those problems at the same time is the only way that we're really going to move forward.
I feel like I want to ask you your opinion on Rami, if you've seen both seasons.
I have.
Okay. Well, please tell me what you think.
I loved season one, and I'm Hindu, right? So, and I like, no Muslims, and I have Muslim friends, but I honestly don't know very much about Islam and being Muslim in America. And so I was very excited about Rami and seeing the show. Season two, I had a little bit of an issue with, and this is like, I don't know. I mean, I haven't really looked into how other people are feeling about it. And here's the other problem is I don't ever want to criticize somebody's work who's a person of color, because we need to move things forward. However, I personally felt like I started to not dislike him as a character because he basically was just becoming an asshole. And my I felt like he was putting Islam in a really bad light by doing that. And my guess is it's like a three season arc. And in season three, he's going to do all the stuff to redeem himself. But as a writer, I kind of questioned if this was the right way to be telling his story.
Yeah. And that kind of is what's leading me into my next question, which is like, do you think people of color, like for example, Black-ish, right? Black-ish isn't a show for Black people. It's a show about Black people for white people and people who don't understand Black culture, right? It's a good introduction. It normalizes a lot of things. You know what I mean? So I feel like Rami being out there, and then there was a movie that came out a little while ago about an Indian guy who loved the Beatles. I never saw it, but it was just like watching the trailer, I was a little triggered because I was like, all right, like he doesn't need to shed his culture to just become, you know what I mean? So I feel like things that are getting picked up right now and things that are like in the ether of entertainment for us. Like, I don't want to say anything bad because obviously they're my people. But, you know, I think it's a larger conversation of like, what do we do when we should be like, our first steps should be like normalizing and creating this, like, this is what we do and it's okay, you know? So I just wanted someone else to agree with me, and I did. So thank you.
Well, you know, I've seen, like, I've been in the business for a little while, and I've seen the evolution of how we're portraying South Asians at the very least, right? Like, right. A few years ago when I was doing Brown Girls, which was a show for Freeform about two Indian women, one from India, one like me, born and brought up in the US. And I had a lot of pushback in terms of how I was portraying these women, right? Like, it wasn't palatable enough for white people. And there was a lot of kind of things that I had to do that I wasn't necessarily excited about. But I realized that, look, if I can get the show on the air, I can do other things down the line, right? Mm-hmm. I didn't get the show on the air. So that is sad. However, as I watch things that are coming out now, I feel like there is an evolution. It's less and less, like, it's getting less and less whitewashed. It's definitely still there. But there is, I want to say, a gradual shift, so that hopefully at some point we can be telling stories that are kind of much more authentic, that won't be confusing to white people, that we will see, you know, what we're looking for and be like, that's exactly what I want to see. But also, you know, the big problem with just media around people of color is, like, we tend to get like one show, one story at a time, right?
So we gotta make it count.
Yeah, you gotta make it count, but you also have to reach the largest audience to make it count, right? And so that is why kind of, you know, the whitewashing happens. And often, like, my husband is white. And I remember when The Big Sick came out. A lot of people were very upset that, like, it's this, you know, movie about a Pakistani man, you know, falling in love with a white girl. I'm like, but that's literally his life. Like, how can you critique? I mean, sure, there are certain things in the movie you can critique about how he portrayed whatever, but you can't critique that.
Right. And you love who you love.
Yeah. And it's like, somebody make a movie about two Pakistani people falling in love, make that movie. But it's hard to get that movie greenlit, you know? So we have to get to a place where we can have multiple stories out. Yeah. And unfortunately right now, like, people who have stories that are just kind of more palatable for a white audience are going to get their stuff greenlit, because that's just where we still are. So I'm not upset that those stories are out there. I think, like, you know, something is better than nothing. But we do need to keep pushing it in a direction. And to your point of, like, critiquing, you know, like, I think we do need to be able to critique each other so that we can move it in that direction. And that's kind of the hard part. Like, I've had a lot of opinions on stuff that comes out by, you know, minority, you know, filmmakers, and I can't really be truthful in public, at least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a really good episode on it on Black AF. It's like episode 5 that, like, talks about the Black community in this. Sorry, Dibesh, I cut you off. Go ahead.
No, it's okay. Shilpi, so I know Ferry was talking about Blackish, and it's like the palatable sort of show to introduce people to Black culture. Do South Asians need a show like that, or some similar sort of thing? You know, it's sort of like introducing someone to butter chicken or chicken tikka masala and then giving them, like, real chicken curry, right? Like, you first give the palatable dish and then you go to, like, the more authentic sort of flavor. Is that something we need to do, you know, from the South Asian standpoint to get our stories published on a more, I guess, a more regular level, or, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it can't hurt to get that. I mean, for the industry has been trying for years to develop, like, an Indian family comedy or a South Asian family comedy, something in, like, a Cosby Show or Blackish or Fresh Off the Boat, anything like that, because I think that is America's introduction to the culture. And again, you know, through that introduction, realizing, oh, they're like a weird, quirky family, just like any other weird, quirky family, right? So I think that will definitely help. And for some reason, it's just never quite worked. None of those scripts that have been written or pilots that have gotten made have ever actually made it on the air. But, you know, maybe one day soon that will change and one of them, you know, will get on the air. But to your point, like, we need the butter chicken, but we need like the real chicken curry too. Like, we need both of them. And I will tell you, when I was doing Brown Girls, like, even though I did everything I could to make it as authentic as I could, I mean, I got massive, massive critique from like Indian and South Asian people over like the smallest jokes, the smallest things. I mean, we are not a monolith. We have very, very different ideas on what is authentic and what is not. And that is that, like, I would assume every culture is like that, right? So, but that's just something we have to deal with. So like the only solution is to get everyone's perspective out there.
Shilpi, I have a couple questions, but before I get to those, I did want to mention the movie that Ferial had mentioned, which I did get to watch. There were actually two of them that came out last year. One was called Blinded by the Light, which featured a Pakistani family that lived in just outside of London, and their son fell in love with Bruce Springsteen. There's actually a great scene from that film where the son leaves England to Philadelphia. He arrives at the airport and it looks like it's a stereotypical scene, you know, brown Muslim kid at an American airport being hounded by TSA. And he says, "Hey, I'm here to see the boss. I'm here to see Bruce Springsteen." And the TSA kind of like, "Yeah, go. You're welcome here in America," right? It's kind of an interesting, funny scene. And the other film that came out, I think a month or two after that, was called Yesterday. And that was the one where the lead character was, I believe he was playing a British Indian, and somehow the Beatles had ceased to exist, and he started playing the Beatles music, and he became famous.
I mixed those two. Sorry.
Yeah. Oh, and it was very easy to mix those two films up because it came out in so close succession, and they both had similar themes. You know, brown kid in England falling in love with popular rock and roll. So that was kind of a great run for us last year. Hopefully we could see more of that in the future. One question I want to ask you, another thing that happened this past week, which was, I look at it as, I'm still not over it, was the cancellation of the Patriot Act. And we lost one of our brothers from the screen. So kind of want to get your take on the value of that show, not just to us brown folk, but to the show, its value to the greater public, because I believe that it was a great show about educating us and informing us in a way that was engaging, informative, and entertaining. So for me, I see the show as a big loss for us, especially when we need shows like that. So I kind of want to get your take on what that show, if some of you watched it, what it meant to you.
Yeah, there's been like a huge kind of outcry and sadness online, at least, when everyone found out that it got canceled. I mean, it is sad. Like, he's doing very important, great work. But I'm not like a huge fan of the show. I've certainly watched several episodes. I can see why it's not everyone's cup of tea. Just kind of creatively, the way the show is put together, it's not going to work for everybody. And it doesn't have the machine behind it like a Daily Show or even, you know, HBO with John Oliver's show. Like, there's just kind of not that advertising push. And, you know, like when Trevor Noah started, you know, took over for Jon Stewart, like it took several years for him to really catch on. But Comedy Central is like, we believe in you, we're gonna stick with it, right? And now, like, everybody loves Trevor Noah, and you know, he's doing well. And this is just how television works. Like, most companies are just not willing to stick it out. And so he's, you know, he's just like a casualty of the industry. But I think, like, he has certainly made a name for himself. And, you know, like, people know how to pronounce his name correctly now, I think. Like, a lot of non-South Asians actually know how to pronounce his name correctly. Like, I really think he's going to bounce back. And there's this whole kind of crew of, like, Muslim South Asians that are kind of coming together now. Like, I was actually watching a live stream of him, Hassan, Riz, Rizwan Ahmed, and this other British guy named Guz, I think it's Guzman Khan, who's got a hilarious, hilarious show. It's on Netflix. It's called Man Like Mobeen. And it's like a lower class British Muslim family. Not something I've ever seen in my life. Like, a working class lower British Muslim family. Really, really great show. and they're all kind of like they're on their own little crew. They're kind of pushing their agenda, which is, you know, let's expose people to who we are and you know, bring everybody together. And so I like TV evolves, and I think the Patriarch just, I guess it needs to evolve into something else. So I'm going to be optimistic that whatever he does next is going to be even better and more popular.
Yeah, I don't think Hassan's going to have any problems bouncing back on his feet. And I do got to give him credit for constantly reminding people how to pronounce his name. He would always say Hassan Minhaj, and he was very particular about, this is my name, this is how you say it, get it right. And I'm kind of in the same boat, because, you know, my name Parimal is very hard for non-Indians, non-South Asians to say. And I get Paramal, Primal, Parimal, I mean, Paramount, Power Bar, I mean, just all the crazy things. And we all get it, right? And I always, you know, when people struggle with my name, I say, you guys made me say Mike Krzyzewski, which, I mean, if you see Mike Krzyzewski's name written out, how do you get Krzyzewski from that? I could say that just fine. You could say Parimal just fine. That's kind of the way I look at it. So I give Hassan plenty of kudos for taking the stand and, you know, saying, this is my name, this is how you say it. And that's part, to me, that's part of the normalization, right? That you don't make us look like a sore thumb because we have a quote unquote weird name, weird to you, right?
Yeah, when I was when I was in kindergarten, my kindergarten teacher mispronounced my name the entire year. My name is Shilpi with a P, but she called me Shelby, which is like a very common name in the South, right? And I didn't correct her the first time. And then after that, I was like, it's my fault now. I didn't correct her. So now I just got to live with it. And the entire year, she mispronounced my name, and I really did not enjoy it. And so after kindergarten was over, I decided I would never let anyone mispronounce my name again, because like, they don't know. So they're not worried about it. But I'm the one who has to sit there and take it every single time they say my name. And also, nobody wants to mispronounce someone's name, you know? So if they do eventually find out later that they've said my name 50 times and it was wrong every single time, they're going to feel horrible, you know? So I feel like I'm actually saving them some pain, and also myself some pain, if we take that little step and we, you know, help them pronounce their names.
So I actually had a similar experience. I think it was in eighth grade. My history teacher refused to say my name right. I mean, I corrected him every single time. That's not my name. It's how you say it every single time for the entire school year. And he wouldn't change. He thought it was funny. And I just didn't know what to do. I was upset. I complained to the principal. I told my parents to do something about it. I was doing everything I could to get this guy just to say my name right once. And he wouldn't do it. I don't even know how to respond to that at some point. It's like, all right. I mean, you know, it's like, what are you going to do? I've literally done everything I could, and nothing's being changed. And, you know, this was in 1989, so it was a long time ago, but I'm hoping the world's a little different now, 31 years later. So, you know, hopefully things are better now. I do have one more follow-up question, and this is more of a broader Hollywood question. One thing we hear a lot, especially from the right, the right of the spectrum, is, oh, Hollywood's full of a bunch of elites, and they're disconnected from reality, and who are they to speak for us? Ironically, a lot of people also watch Hollywood products, so there's that. But I kind of want to get your take on, how do you respond to people who say just that, that Hollywood is disconnected, it's full of a bunch of elites, and who are we in the industry to say anything about anything?
I mean, it's not full of a bunch of elites. Like, most of Hollywood is like working class people struggling to survive and pay their mortgage, just like the rest of the country. But here's what's unlike the rest of the country. I'm a writer and director, right? And I spend the majority of my time working, thinking about racism and how to make people come together. And, you know, like thinking about people and their behaviors and their assumptions and why, you know, we have these problems, and how can I, through my work, try to help people come together and solve some of the problems we have as a country, right? That's like 8 hours a day what I do. And what a lot of people in Hollywood are doing, especially if you're a person of color who's a creator, that's what you're doing all the time. You're like, how can I represent the people that I want to make, you know, films and TV about correctly and authentically, but also, you know, introduce them to the world in a way that the world wants to see them. You know, and so it's like the average person is not thinking along those lines as they go about their daily lives, right? So I would say, like, we are very, very sensitive in Hollywood to whatever problems are happening in this country because we are all actively trying to solve them with our media. And I don't know how many people are actively trying to solve the problems of their the country through whatever their job is, but it's definitely not everybody. So, you know, I'm biased, of course, I'm in the industry, but we're definitely not elites. Many of us are very poor. Many of us have come here from somewhere else, right? So we all have a very, very kind of average American background that we're drawing from, whatever that means. And, you know, we are all here trying to, you know, be successful in our own right. But that always has to do with making sure the country itself is successful, you know? So we're in it in the same way everybody else is in it.
You mentioned coming from somewhere else. You came from North Carolina. I'm kind of curious if you give us some perspective on what you know about the politics of North Carolina. Where does the state stand in terms of its leanings? Is it a purple state now? Is it still red? Is it leaning blue? Kind of just what do you know about North Carolina politics?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure where it exactly it is at this moment. I am hoping that it is very purple at this moment. I know it went for Obama, I believe both times for Obama, but then it did go for Trump in this last election. And, you know, it's a very, like every other state, you know, in the metropolitan areas, like people tend to be Democrat. And as soon as you get into rural areas, they turn Republican. I talked to one person today in my phone banking and I asked, you know, are you going to be supporting Joe Biden in this next election? And he says, oh, no, I like my freedom and my guns. And so, you know, there's certainly going to be a lot of those people in North Carolina. They're going to be there. But North Carolina, I think, is a little different from the rest of the South because it is just northern, like it's right under Virginia. And so we don't tend to be as entrenched in like Republican cultural politics as some of the other southern states are, right? We like to differentiate ourselves from South Carolina. We think we're better than South Carolina. And so I feel like there's hope. There's actually hope that North Carolina can go blue again, because it went blue for Obama. And, you know, we're in just this very unusual time now. It's like, it kind of feels like everything's up for grabs. So we have to like do the work to grab it though. So that's what I'm trying to do.
So if you could summarize in kind of a broader perspective, what is at stake at this election? I mean, you hear on one side, you know, guns and gods and freedoms, and, you know, on the other side, it's, you know, everything else is up for being eliminated. What would you say is at stake in this November election?
I want to say the country's sanity is at stake in this election. I feel like we are all going to go insane if we continue to be as divided as we are on like everything with no, there seems to be no hope of coming to a compromise or even like a friendly compromise between people. We have to talk to each other more. That's one of the problems with this quarantine is we can't physically kind of really see people and talk to them in person, which is a big way that you know, connect. So I'm really hoping with this election to bring somebody like Joe Biden into office who is a genuinely nice person. His agenda is not to divide the country, which it feels like is Trump's agenda, right? And so I think that is really what's at stake. Like we have to start moving towards each other instead of away from each other. And that's kind of really what I'm hoping will happen.
Sebastian Farrell, did you want to add any questions before I wrap up with one more?
So, okay. One last thing about career. Where do you think we are going to be in the next 5 years as far as storytelling? Because it does, you're right. It does feel like we are heading in a direction of listening to more people of color, hiring more people of color. I feel like I'm like on job boards that I get forwarded that I just see way more like, oh, like, you know, we're hiring people of color. This is an opportunity. More diversity initiatives. Where do you think we're going to be in 5 years, do you think?
Wow. I mean, to be totally honest, I don't think we're going to be that much further along in 5 years than we are now. There are certainly, as you said, there are certainly some positive things happening. A lot of behind the camera, I feel like, is getting a little better. It's hard to translate it into front of the camera. And so I think that's kind of like when you're looking for it, you're not necessarily seeing it on screen, but it is very, very slowly happening behind the camera. I think it's just, it's just like a very, very long, hard push. Like, we can't really let up. We can't give up. We have to all keep doing what we're doing. We have to be willing to speak up. That is the other thing. Like, I've been in many situations where the people in power who are not people of color, they're just used to doing things a certain way. And they're not thinking about, like, how to change the industry for the better in this instance, right? In general, they're like, oh, yeah, we totally need to do all these things. But, like, when it comes down to a decision that they're making right then, they're not thinking about diversity and the general betterment of the industry, right? So it's like pointing things out in a very specific way, like right here, right now, you can make a difference. Can you think about this a little differently? That is kind of my call to action to people. Like, and it's really, really hard because when you're a person of color and you're new in your job, as a lot of people are new right now, you do not want to be a voice of dissent, right? You do not want to bring up a criticism or a critique because it's going to be your job. It's a high likelihood you'll be labeled difficult and you'll get, you know, blacklisted or something. But like my personal kind of feeling of that is like you have to speak up because nobody else is going to do it. And at the end of the day, like, you're not going to be better off by not speaking up, you know, because we're all going to be held back. So just speak up. And I think if we work really, really hard, it's my same philosophy for this election, right? Like, we have to work really, really hard to get Joe Biden elected. And by the way, after he's elected, we have to work really, really hard so that he brings about the policy changes that we want. And we have to work really, really hard to make sure that the industry moves forward with its kind of push for diversity and getting people of color in front of and behind the camera. And we have to work really, really hard at our jobs to make money. So like, we just have to keep working really, really hard and have faith that the hard work will pay off.
Cool. Shilpi, one more question. You mentioned earlier on in this conversation about your phone banking, you had one mean person or somewhat of a mean person. You didn't tell us what happened with that call. Can you describe that conversation if you're comfortable doing such?
Oh my God, it was hilarious. Okay, so the way it works is this kind of, it's like an automatic dialer. So you kind of just wait until like someone picks up the phone and then their name pops up on screen. And it was a male name, right? So I was like, hi, can I speak with whatever his name was? Let's say John. But a woman answered the phone. And she's like, who are you looking for? I don't know. I said, whatever his name is. And she's like, she gets really, really upset. And she actually started cursing at me. She's like, what? Who are you people that keep calling me looking for him? Okay. He is not here. He ain't been around for years. Okay. And it was very clear that this guy was like, I want to say like an ex-boyfriend or like a former husband who had kind of done her wrong and written her phone number down for all kinds of stuff. Right. And so she was getting phone calls from all kinds of organizations looking for him and not her. And she had just kind of had it. So she was like going off on me on the phone. And I immediately made up that story in my head. I have no idea if that's actually what happened, but like, that's what it sounded like to me. And I just want to be like, girl, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry about what he did to you. You did not deserve it. But that was like the funniest thing that happened today on the phone banking.
So did you have a conversation with her afterwards or did it stop there?
No, I mean, when someone's hostile, they tell you just get off the phone. Like you're not going to be really changing any hearts and minds at that point. So I was just like, I'm so sorry to bother you. I will put you on the do not call list and you go on with your day.
Wow. Well, thank you for doing the phone bank. That was pretty awesome. And hopefully you'll do a few more and hopefully you flip some votes and we could have a new tenant in the White House. Right. And you know, worst case scenario, you know, you're asking about 5 years from now, Farrell. And I as much as, you know, I don't want to politicize this podcast too much, obviously, but you know, not I, th- I think it's fair to say all four of us don't want to see Trump win in November, but 5 years from now, if he is elected, he's out. And I guess that's the one thing I'm holding on to, that even if it doesn't go right this year, 2025, we can move on and rebuild there, and hopefully there's something to rebuild. And we'll see what happens. But, you know, everybody should go out and vote, obviously, and, you know, vote your opinion. Obviously, you know, I can't get everybody on the same page, but hopefully enough people vote, and they vote with their sane mind, and they see the better candidate of the two, which to us is obvious. So with that, Shilpi, did you want to add anything else before we call it a day?
No, I think we covered all the big things. Except for COVID. I don't know if there's anything more we can say about that. But
well, okay, just tell us from your perspective, how have you been holding up? How have you used this time to kind of work on your craft? How tough is it in Hollywood because of the pandemic?
I'm holding up okay. You know, I was, before quarantine hit, I was working from home developing this Disney Channel pilot. So when quarantine started, I was working from home developing this Disney Channel pilot. Nothing actually changed for me. So I was like, party, yeah. You know, again, being an introvert, like I don't like really miss much about what happened when quarantine hit. The best thing was like, I didn't have to go out anymore. Like I only really went out if I like really wanted to. But I do miss like vacations and going on, you know, like now, like all of that has become just so much more difficult because you have to like worry about sanitation or germs or whatever. And, you know, like we had been planning a big trip to South Africa in December, which like now is, you know, that's not gonna happen. We were actually, I was hoping to be in New Zealand in September. That's not happening, you know? So those things are sad, but I do fully recognize that this is just a temporary thing and I'm not gonna die in the next 2 years, I hope. And so we can certainly get back to really, really full lives. And we just need to kind of hold on and do our best right now. So that kind of mentally is where I'm trying to get myself. But I have feel, I, like I said, I feel like my surge capacity has been depleted. And vacations were usually how I built up new capacity. And since I can't really do it in the same way, I'm now trying to figure out, like, what do I do now? How do I get to a place where I'm inspired and excited about working and about doing all these other things that I want to do?
You know, it was interesting. I think last season we tried to have you on, and when I reached out to you, you were on vacation, if I remember correctly. That happened, right?
I feel like that did probably happen, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Shilpi. This was a great chat, and, you know, we'd love to have you on again maybe after the election and kind of just review what happened and go over our feelings when that happens. And hopefully you would have another project, too, that are in production at the same time as well. And personally, I know you know that I cover the environment as well, and it'd be nice if we could have a chat about that. One thing you and I have talked about before in the past, at least online, is coastal access. I know it's a thing in North Carolina, it's a thing here in California, but it's very different in both states.
So I gotta say thank you, because you're the one who really brought that to my attention. Like I never really thought about it before, but I saw all the stuff you were posting, and I started reading about it, like Hollister Ranch and everything, and it's just so, I'm so glad that there is a coastal commission, even if there are issues with it. But like the fact that somebody was thinking about that was great.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, you mentioned Hollister Ranch. There was also Banning Ranch under Newport Beach. Hollister Ranch is just north of Santa Barbara. There was another place up in Half Moon Bay I can't remember his name. He was that big Silicon Valley guy, Indian guy. That case actually took his grievance to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court actually gave him the middle finger, like, no, you rich guy can't take away coastal access from the everyday person. You just can't do that. And he kind of shut up after that. So that was interesting. So we'd love to have a chat with you about that at some point down the line. So, but in any event, thank you, Shilpi. This was great. And keep doing what you're doing. Where can we find you? If someone wants to get in touch with you, they want to send you an idea for a movie, or they want to find out more about your work, how can they get in touch with you?
Probably the easiest way is my Twitter. It's kind of like Shilpi backwards, but phonetically it's Iplish. So Iplish.
You know, I never put two and two together on that. I never thought about that. All right. So @Iplish on Twitter. Okay. Dibesh, now off to you. Where can you find Storytellers in Action?
So you can find us on the iOS podcast app, on iTunes, Apple Music, on Google Play Music, which will become YouTube Red soon, the Google Podcast app, or anywhere you enjoy listening to podcasts on.
And of course, you could search for Storytellers in Action. You can search for The Asian Highway, and you'll find us on any of those platforms. We're also on social media. Do any search on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter for The Asian Highway, and you'll find us. Also, be sure to visit our website, ah1.live, for news and feature stories. And of course, on the podcast side of things, be sure to rate us, download us, subscribe to us. It all helps us get a larger platform out there for everyone who speaks on our shows. And Farrell, have you been expanding your Wash Your Hands 2020 list?
I have been. I have a playlist on Spotify called Wash Your Hands 2020, and I am adding to it every day.
Nice. So anybody out there who wants a good playlist on Spotify, be sure to subscribe to that. And obviously, you could also, like I said, you could all, be sure to check out all of our other properties online as well. And again, thank you to Shilpi on behalf of Farrell and Nabesh. Thank you for tuning in. This has been Storytellers in Action. This is our fifth season. We're doing this via quarantine remotely. And we appreciate everybody who's been tuning in and listening. So thank you so much.
Be good, y'all.